Today is Monday, the 27th of March in the year 2000. We're in East Lansing. I am Jeff Charlie, interviewing Dr. John Cantlon for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be celebrated or commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, we're tape recording this oral history today, Dr. Cantlon. Do you give us permission to do that for this interview?
I do.
I'd like to start first with a little bit about your own educational and professional background. Where did you do your undergraduate work? Where did you grow up?
Okay, I grew up in Sparks, Nevada. Did my primary school in the public schools of Sparks. Graduated from Sparks High in 1939 and started at the University of Nevada. I completed 3 years, but by then the war was underway. And so I joined the Navy in 1942 and spent 4 years with the Navy. Then came out and took roughly a year to get things worked out, and I got back to the University of Nevada and finished in 1947. And then I went to Rutgers University, where I did my doctorate, and I had enough accumulated work that I finished my doctorate in 1950. I then went to George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and was on the faculty there in the Department of Botany for 2 years. And then I took a leave of absence conduct the ecology of the Arctic slope of Alaska. And so that was an Air Force project. At the time, very hush-hush, because what it was engaged in was getting the ground truth that would determine the quality control on the camera that went into the U-2 spy plane.
Oh, really?
They were doing the optics for that camera, the big folded optical axis. We didn't know that at the time. It was very hush-hush. And our project then lasted, and I went to Boston University for a year, worked in the Arctic. And while I was there, Michigan State University recruited me. They had recruited me earlier, and I couldn't come because I had committed to go to Boston University. So I came here in 1954.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about your war experience in terms of what were your main duties in the Navy?
Well,
where did you serve?
I was a Navy flyer, and for the first 2 years of my service, I instructed pilots in how to instrument fly, and then in the last part of my instruction experience, I taught fighter pilots. And then I joined the fleet and ended up in VF-37, well, it was Air Group 37, was the whole group, but the fighter squadron was VF and the other one was VT. It was a joint torpedo fighter bomber squadron, and I was a fighter pilot with F-6Fs. We were supposed to go aboard the USS Sangamon, which had gotten badly damaged in retreating from, Saipan, one of the islands, island battles in the late part of the war. The Sangamon was so badly damaged we couldn't go aboard, so we ended up stationed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, with further training while a new carrier came off the lines, one of the Jeep carriers. I had been qualified in Jeep carrier landings in the Atlantic. So we then got on the USS Sadar, and we were there when the war ended.
Okay.
And so we were getting ready for the invasion of Japan.
So most of your overseas then was in the Pacific?
Yes, yes.
Okay. After you got out of the service, what rank were you, did you end up when you
I
got out?
I was a lieutenant.
Lieutenant?
Navy.
Okay.
Right. Captain in the...
in the Army.
Yeah.
Then you used the GI Bill after...
Oh, yes. After. Oh, yes. And finished my last year at the University of Nevada, and then finished 3 years. I was entitled to 4 years, mm-hmm. so that's why I hurried my PhD mm-hmm. so that I could cover it.
The in terms of you mentioned you were recruited by Michigan State.
Yes.
Who did the recruiting?
Bill Drew.
Bill Drew.
Bill okay. Drew was the chairman. He just died recently. He would have been a good one to interview.
Okay. And what department was he in?
Botany and plant pathology.
Okay. And he was familiar with your yes. published work and
yes.
research.
Yes. Okay. And he knew my major professor at Rutgers, and he knew my professor at the University of Nevada, who had gotten me interested in ecology.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would you say that was a new field at that time, or just only a name? Or
yes, it's interesting. Ecology, of course, has been around since the turn of the century, really the 1880s, 1890s. There were already a few books in ecology. But my wife has often commented, nobody knew what ecology was, and just about the time it began to be interesting, you became provost. Nobody knew what the provost was.
So your early years at Michigan State, when you first arrived, how would you say the campus was different?
Well, I had been, of course, for 4 years at the University of Nevada. Mm-hmm. Spread over a total of almost 8 years. And I had been at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And the first dramatic thing is the scale and scope of this campus. It's one of the bigger campuses in the country. Mm-hmm. And beautifully landscaped. And I think in the old days was even better landscaped in quality because it was cheaper to do. And mm-hmm. there was less of it to take care of. And so it was a beautiful place, particularly for a person trained in the botanical sciences, mm-hmm. ecology. Mm-hmm. So that was one aspect of it. The other thing that was interesting is that the graduate program in botany here, while it was one of the older graduate programs on campus, was still very small. And it was a time to recruit graduate students who were, you know, thinking about coming here. It was a place that hadn't a long tradition of graduate programs in ecology in my field, so it was a while to recruit graduate students.
So your part in, you took part in that expansion in the department?
Oh, very much yeah. so, yeah. yeah.
Who were some of your first students that you recall, or graduate students? Do you remember any of them?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Some of those early years?
Yeah. Bill Gillis comes to mind. He was kind of an institution here for a while. Mm-hmm. And Bill Malcolm, who got his PhD degree here, who is now in New Zealand and is in the cattle business and teaches at a community college, I guess it is, in New Zealand, in Nelson. And there's a whole Bill Overlees, another grad student who got his degree here, PhD.
So did some of them stay here at Michigan State, or did most of them leave?
No, all of my graduate students left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In terms of you came as an associate professor, or
yes,
or
as mm-hmm. a, you know, came to as Michigan an associate State? Professor.
Yeah. Were you ever department chair here?
No,
in that department?
No. I served for, you know, a few days for Bill Drew, but never formally designated.
Okay. What did you see in terms of your own research when you first came? Were there any?
Well, the kind of interesting thing was I was interested in getting a major study area to do experimental ecological work, which was not very common in those days. Much of the early ecological research was descriptive and describing communities, and I had done my own thesis, and I'd done an undergraduate thesis at the University of Nevada on descriptions of vegetation and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to actually do some experiments to see cause and effect and that sort of thing. And I had very great difficulty getting a research area. Much of the land at that time was under the control of the College of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And we were in the College of Natural Science. Mm-hmm. And there was a certain amount of...
turf battles?
Turf battles, oh yes. Yes, I got into some very interesting turf battles with our agriculture. So it was a long time before I got a really satisfactory research site. And interestingly, I had gone down to Michigan State University's biological station at Gull Lake to see if I could get a research area down there. I got no sympathy at all. It was also under control of agriculture. Mm-hmm. And they were running it as a dairy farm. So about that time, the University of Michigan offered me a summer faculty appointment at their biological station at Douglas Lake, which I accepted. Mm-hmm. And then for several years taught ecology at the University of Michigan at Douglas Lake and did some research work there.
Did it open up after you came back? Or?
Yes. we recruited a new director for the the biological station. George Lauf came in, and by the way, you might be very interested in getting him to talk to you, because that biological station has now become a national ecological research center.
Mm-hmm. And he's still in the area?
Yes, he's down there. Mm-hmm. And retired too. Mm-hmm. But So I set up and had a research center there, and had several other graduate students, John Caruso and Buford Holt, both got their research completed down there.
Mm-hmm. Now, your specific study at KBS.
What we were interested in is what are the sorting mechanisms that determines how a biological community gets structured. Well, how does that happen? Mm-hmm. And there are two very opposing theories. One based on the more the European view that a community is an organized thing like a human body or an individual body, very tightly organized. Most Americans don't really think that way. And we don't have the same tradition that the European ecologists have, where ecology sort of came out of taxonomy descriptions. Mm-hmm. We really are more physiologically or process-oriented. And so, and by the time we were getting involved in it, the science of statistics and so on, mathematics of statistics were coming down. And so the other opposing view is there's no structure at all. It's just a probabilistic thing. Well, that's not true either. Mm-hmm. There's a fair amount of structure there, but there's a high level of chance involved in precisely how it gets organized. So we were trying to look at those processes.
Mm-hmm. In those early years in the 50s, how would you characterize the student body here at Michigan State?
Oh, well, it was almost entirely undergraduate in the early 50s when I came in 54. Very few graduate students. And since the university was in a very, very rapidly growing point in the 1950s, when I came here it was 18,000 students. Mm-hmm. And by the time I came into central administration, it was 40,000. So you see, not quite a factor of three, but more than double. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that the legislature never really funded the growth of the university. Hannah had a strategy that if you build it, they'll come, mm-hmm. meaning the money. Mm-hmm. Well, in part it was true, but it wasn't one for one. So the budget of the university became more and more constrained for the size of the student body. And a lot of ingenuity went into improving the quality of how you could instruct students at a lower cost. Mm-hmm. University College was one of those inventions.
Were you involved in that at all, or?
No, I guess I would be classed as an opponent of the idea.
Okay. Against the traditional disciplines.
Well, no, it was more a matter that the concept was to bring about the integration. And I have a very strong feeling, and still hold today, that you got to have something to integrate. Mm-hmm. So you really need to build your fundamentals early and get your integrating courses later in the program. Mm-hmm. And I think as they did away with the University College as it was, mm-hmm. and built it later, I think we eventually brought that about. Mm-hmm. But those initial general courses, while very good in what they were set about to do, tried to integrate before the youngsters really had enough basis mm-hmm. to really see what was going on. You could learn what was being presented to you, obviously, but the significance of it and the depth to which you could apply it was very circumscribed mm-hmm. over what I think the later model became.
In your early teaching, were you primarily involved in graduate education, or
no? Primarily in undergrad because okay. there were no graduate oh, that's right. students when I first got here, and what graduate students we had mostly in undergraduate courses, mm-hmm. and during my career, we built almost all of the graduate courses in the department during the time I was here.
Mm-hmm. Were these large lecture or
well,
small or
mixture,
rare variety?
I had my ecology class, I had about 80 in the ecology class and probably about 40 in plant geography. Systematics had maybe 40 or 50. Mm-hmm. You know, so they were not big, not multi-hundreds like mm-hmm. some of the old instructional courses they had, beginning psych, mm-hmm. beginning business courses and so on were monstrous.
Mm-hmm. Did you, in terms of administration, how did you first get involved in administration here at Michigan State?
Well, it's kind of an interesting tale. I took a leave of absence. I've been very active at the federal level since I had gotten started at George Washington University, and ecology was just really beginning to get underway. I'd been advising Oak Ridge National Laboratory and some of the National Academy committees, and reviewing papers, proposals for the National Science Foundation. And so in 1965, the National Science Foundation invited me. I had been on their review committee and panel for quite a while. They invited me to be the program director for environmental biology, which was ecology. And so I accepted with the understanding that I'd only do it for 1 year because I was building a graduate program here. And, frankly, the department didn't want me to be gone more than a year. And I felt it wasn't wise for the university to give up and have a temporary in for more than a year.
So you took a one-year leave of absence?
I took a one-year leave of absence, went to Washington, D.C., and was present as NSF really got the big environmental programs underway. It was very interesting. I had a lot of fun doing it.
Mm-hmm. In the Johnson administration?
Yes, yeah. Johnson administration.
Mm-hmm. Were there any... who was the head of NSF at that time? Do you remember that? It wasn't meant to be a quiz.
Yeah.
Is there anybody that you worked with closely in the government?
Well, Harvey Carlson was the head of biology division, and Glenn Seaborg was head of the National Science Foundation. Glenn Seaborg, who was a chemist from the University of California, Berkeley. We had a lot of work going on. I had been on the National Academies, National Research Council, Division of Biology and Agriculture for a while before then. So I've been involved in a lot of the big national ecological and environmental questions. Mm-hmm. So when I came back to campus after 65, 66, when I was at NSF, I was pretty active on campus in the environmental, on the environmental issues. And of course they were very hot as you were coming up to the 70s Earth Day. Mm-hmm. First Earth Day was 1970. And just the year before, in 1969, John Hanna retired. And Walter Adams was the acting president. And I think it was Walter's view that the provost should also retire, or be relieved, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so Jake Neville, who had been the provost, and I had been very active with Jake Neville. I was on the university committee for the residential colleges. I was on the educational policies committee here. And Walter Adams called me over one day after I got back in 1969, must have been early in the year of 1969, probably March, April, somewhere in there, maybe a little later. But he said he'd like to have me come over and be the provost. Well, I said, geez, I'm not interested, Walter, in being a provost, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. Jake is doing a great job. Now Jake is leaving. And I said, no, I just wouldn't do it. I'm just getting back on campus. I'm getting my graduate program back up. I've got my research grants now active again, and so I don't want to do it. So I left. And I got a call a few days later. And he said, John, either you take this or I'm going to have to give it. And he named another name. I said, geez, that'd be a mistake.
So you were drafted again.
He said, take it for a year or two. He said, I'm only going to stay in this a year or two. He said, take it for a year or two and then you can get out. So that's how I got into it.
And the irony is he got out.
And he got out and I stayed in because the student unrest, see, took off. I came in July 1 of 69. Mm-hmm. And that fall, things were really getting hot.
Mm-hmm. What on those days or on those issues of the war and other things that the students were involved in, challenges to the administration, what are some of your recollections about that?
Well, the most dramatic thing is that our son was a Marine and was killed in Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Getting
back to the, I could get home. Getting back to the issues, the students, of course, were agitated in part about that, but it was a much, much broader set of things, because the blacks, of course, were pressing for more equitable treatment, and that was a subset of what was going on. The typical thing, like our big riot last year, there's a certain amount of chemistry of rioting. Mm-hmm. Which has very little to do with what I would call the psychological, the national psychological importance of the event. You know, losing a damn basketball game is trivial.
Yeah.
So you had that kind of thing going on, which is just the chemistry of youth and mob behavior. Mm-hmm. And just about that time, Walter Adams stepped down as president, and Cliff Wharton came in. And I tendered my resignation to Cliff Wharton. And he said, well, geez, I don't want to have to replace, you know, senior officials right in the middle of this mess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'll stay on. And I did. And, of course, by then the thing was really gathering momentum and there was damage on campus and the the tent city was set up here on the banks of the Red Cedar and the board was ticked off. Mm-hmm. One of the funniest events. And by the way, my text that I've given you there, I've tried to focus on the humorous aspects of my career.
In a tough time.
entertaining to my grandkids, see, mm-hmm. That's why I wrote it. So I keep these humorous ones. And the board had been berating Cliff Wharton, who, of course, was a black. And so there was some of the board members, I think, recognized that there was a racial aspect to some of their thoughts about him. I never felt that he was far from black as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. But we were over at the Kellogg Center, and the board was just really beating up on all of us administrators because the tent city was out there. They were getting hate letters from taxpayers and everything, and telling us that we, you know, had to clean this up, we couldn't do anything. And at the time, they had members of the campus police monitoring what the student activists were doing. Later came out that they weren't supposed to be doing this, but anyway, they did. Excuse me. So one of the fellows came in and told President Wharton, the activists have learned that the board is meeting over here in Kellogg Center and they're on their way. And Cliff Wharton, he whispered that in his ear, and Cliff Wharton said, I understand that the student activists are on their way here. Like a covey of quail. Those the trustees disappeared.
meeting was adjourned.
It was adjourned. They didn't want to face the activists. Yeah. So there were a lot of things like that. Very tense. Mm-hmm. We had long, long days because we try to recap what was going on, get things underway. But it would be a mistake to say that that period of great unrest was a period in which nothing happened. We got the medical school started during that period, the human medical school. Mm-hmm. And we're doing very well. You know, most of the students here were not involved. Mm-hmm.
It was a core.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and a lot of them were off campus. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, see, our worst problems came after the University of Michigan closed its doors in the end of April. Mm-hmm. We went into June at that time under the quarter system. Mm-hmm. So we'd get their red hots plus all of the hangers-on, and we had high school kids in. Mm-hmm. So very much like this riot here.
There were high schoolers.
Most of the activists and so on were not Michigan State students. Mm-hmm.
If you, was there any degree of resentment about the authority of, or the way that Hannah, I know Hannah had been gone, but was the students, how did they react to his style of leadership?
Well, Hannah brooked no nonsense. You know, he came out of a time when the president was the president. Mm-hmm. And he had full authority because he had the full backing of the board. Mm-hmm. Well, you may recall that late in his term here as president, they had the Constitutional Convention. And the Constitutional Convention changed the makeup of the board from governor appointees, where you could get real statesmen to serve, to elected trustees, and you get a totally different class of people. Mm-hmm. Because these are non-paying. And in Michigan politics, the Democratic Party essentially were controlled largely by the unions, still are. And so you had a very different board of trustees that came in and viewed Hannah's running of the school, of the university, much the way union people would view an autocratic thing. You know, they
labor management issues.
Yeah, exactly. They thought the faculty ought to be organized and all the workers ought to be organized and heck with this business. And Don Stevens, who was one of the real active union-oriented guys, says there's no due process here. So anyway, he would have tossed out students that did things of the ilk that later happened here. He would have tossed them out unilaterally. Mm-hmm.
In your time, so you came to the provost at a really tough time in the university in some respects. But would you talk a little bit about the medical schools? What role did you play in that? In bringing them or attracting them?
I was the provost. Came in after the first 2-year medical program had gotten started.
Okay, two year.
Yeah, and so I presided over bringing them to the 4-year and did some of the arguments down at the legislature. Had lots of, I have to tell you a story about that. I don't know whether you've heard the term or the name Jerry Faberman.
Yes, mm-hmm. He just died.
Unfortunately, you should have interviewed him. I don't know whether my throat's going to hold out. But
okay, let's pause right here. Just a minute. I'm getting ready to...